Just about every day, we get a reminder that there's still some basic understanding lacking in America about how to live and get along with people who look and sound different from us. Black, white, brown, red, and more. We're supposed to be a great melting pot. Pick your own metaphor for what we are instead. Our guest this hour puts forth some ideas on how we can think about race in America and how we can guide a new generation into thinking about race in new ways. Jennifer Harvey's book is called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Jennifer Harvey focuses her work, as you can tell, on racial justice and white anti-racism. She's a professor at Drake University in Des Moines, the author of several books and many articles, and an ordained minister in American Baptist churches. Jennifer Harvey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. So this is a familiar ground to you. Is this just really a shifting of the focus to a younger audience?
Well, it's certainly familiar ground. It's shifting of the focus to same age audience, but around raising young ones, which was new for me in my life in my late 30s when I realized I wasn't sure how to do anti-racism with my 3-year-old.
So your own parenting really produced this book.
Absolutely.
So for parents who might skip past this book thinking it's not an issue, you know, we don't see color, we just see people, what would you say to that?
Well, the first thing I would invite them to do is take a look at the news and see how much race and racism and conversations about difference are just continuing to embroil us as a nation. And the second thing I would do is let them know that we have seen study after study show that teaching children generically to value equality actually doesn't translate into anti-racism. And so colorblindness just simply doesn't work.
So they really have to recognize what racism is. They have to know something about it to be able to be an anti-racist.
Exactly. If they don't know what racism is, they certainly can't get to anti-racism.
There's a story of you, Jennifer, at 6 in school and awareness of race. Would you share that story with us?
Sure. So I grew up in Denver, Colorado, at a time when busing was in place to ensure integration of schools. And so I was bused across town to an integrated public school. And one day in first grade, I was a racial minority in my school because lots of white families had pulled their kids from public schools at the time of busing. And a friend of mine who was white, we were standing outside the bathroom in the hallway, and she said, "Hey, Jenny, we should start a white girls club." And I was a little confused, and she said, "You know, because there's only 6 white girls in our class." And I have this moment of remembering that I literally kind of looked down at my arms and thought, "Oh, she's right. I am a white girl." And our teacher happened to be passing by, who also was herself white, and she overheard this conversation, and she quickly and quite angrily snapped at us and said, "Girls, I don't ever want to hear you talking like that again." And that response for a 6-year-old who was quite interested in pleasing her teacher was pretty shocking and shame-inducing, and it made me kind of think, wow, I don't want to ever go near that. Whatever that was, I don't want to go near that ever again. And so I didn't for a long time, despite the hope that integration was seeking to achieve of helping kids navigate difference in effective ways.
So what she was saying was, don't talk about this, not now, not ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was probably appropriately concerned that she was hearing something racist and negative and something she wanted to ward off. And so her impulse came from the right place, I think. But what she didn't realize she did was effectively shut down the conversation about race. And the fact of the matter is, if kids do not have adults partner with them to talk about, explore, and navigate the complexities of race and difference in the United States, then we set them up for failure in terms of living in a diverse society well.
So now you are a teacher, and what have you seen happen when you or any other teacher announces, we're going to take up a unit on race now?
Well, I watch students of color in my classes say, "Great, we're ready, let's talk about this." And I like to say I watch my white students look like deer in headlights, and they say things like, "Please, could we talk about something easier like abortion?" You know. So what I find is that white students just come in not prepared and very afraid that they're going to say something wrong. And what I've started realizing and what I tell all of my students is that, you know, in the United States, families of color tend to teach their kids calculus, and white families tend to teach their kids basic addition. And that when I say we're going to have a conversation about race, what white students hear is, oh my gosh, I only know addition and she's going to do calculus with us. And so that we have, you know, we're not on even ground in terms of what we know, what we understand, and how much we've been taught to talk about these issues. And so we have to play some serious catch up with white people.
Do you find it universal or nearly so that students of color that you've had have been given the talk about being careful about the police and how to handle themselves around police, all of that?
Absolutely. Nearly universal. And not only about the talk, which is certainly there, but about many things from, you know, better teachings about actual U.S. American history. Their parents, their caregivers, their loved ones have filled in the gaps for them, about how difference actually impacts them. And so just on almost every measure, most, not all, but most students of color have had a very explicit sort of racial education at home.
So before we get to a break in about a minute here, let's have a do-over with Mrs. B. If you were counseling Mrs. B as an adult today, how would you suggest that she handle that moment where the little girl suggests, let's start a white students club?
Great. I would first say, Mrs. B, take a deep breath. Recognize in yourself a lot of anxiety and fear that's coming from your own sort of unprocessed racial learnings. Second, realize these six-year-olds are actually noticing something real, and they don't have ill intent. And so what would it look like to say, hey, girls, I want to talk about that with you. What do you mean, a white girls' club? How are we noticing difference in the classroom? What do you think that means? And sort of start on a journey with them and ultimately with all the kids in the class about how race is playing out in the classroom in all of the ways, including lots of really wonderful and good ways.
Much more to talk about with Jennifer Harvey. Her book is called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Yes, there is some burden that falls on the parents of white kids, and we'll get into why and how to do this. And we're talking about not being colorblind, but being race conscious instead. We'll come back and talk more with Jennifer Harvey. You can join the conversation by phone and email when we return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're going to continue talking about race in this hour. And as we heard from our guest a moment ago, when she brings that up in her classroom, she finds the white kids often look like deer in the headlights, which is a large part of the reason why she wrote this book called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. We're talking about taking the opportunities to recognize that, yes, people are different physically and how society treats them socially, to talk about race consciousness instead of color blindness. These are some of the basic concepts you can visit with us on the Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And not being flippant here, Jennifer, but the book was published in 2017, and I wonder how many times, just in trying to get it to press, you thought, oh boy, here's another incident we could put in a rewrite.
Yes, Jeff. I mean, that's true. This year has been just incredible, incident after incident, and now we're thinking about high school yearbooks.
Oh, right. So you do address the title and concept. Why for white parents and no other?
Well, in part because parents of color are already having these conversations with their children, and they're teaching them what anti-racism looks like because they must for their own children to be able to survive and thrive in a racially unjust America. And it's white families who are not having those conversations, and so that's part of the reason that it's specific. But also, my white 8-year-old does not have the same experience in society as, say, a friend of hers who's 8 and who is African-American. And so for my white child to be an anti-racist living person who is white, she gets privileges and access and insulation that her friend does not. And so she needs different skills, different tools, and a different vocabulary to take that seriously, even if the goal of racial justice is the same.
Let's get a little further into some of your terminology here. You prefer anti-racism to non-racism. It sounds like it's more of an active thing than a passive thing.
Yeah, it's not only active. It's about learning when kids encounter racism, when teenagers see racism, which they all do, that they are prepared and equipped to intervene and challenge it. So non-racism doesn't allow that. Anti-racism does. Non-racism is also not really a possibility because in a society that is as unjust and full of racism as ours is, Beverly Daniel Tatum talks about racism being smog in the air that we are all breathing all the time. Non-racism ends up impossible because you're either allowing those racist, those sort of toxins in the air to infiltrate your body, or you're actively warding them off. And that's what anti-racism tries to signal.
I did notice that quote about racism like a smog in the air. So, it's not like you're going to wear masks for this. And again, I'm not trying to be a funny guy here.
Sure.
But what do you do then to insulate your child, or at least to, I guess it's not about insulation really, it's about treatment post-exposure, isn't it?
It's both. And so, I mean, I think it's actually, it's not flippant. It's helpful because I think of anti-racism as the mask, in essence. Part of that means we need to start talking with our kids about race all the time so they're not just being impacted by it without having an ongoing and developmentally growing dialogue about it. So lots of white kids we know not only perceive racial difference, perceive injustice, but they also know that they're not really supposed to talk about it. So partly, preventing the toxins from infecting us is setting the table with our kids so they know race is something we talk about. That's step one. And also, teaching kids what racism is actually a preventative mechanism for it impacting them. I mean, it still impacts all of us, but I'm much more able to prevent racism from sort of creating implicit bias, impacting me in ways that I'm not aware of, if I have a language and a lens for talking about it, seeing it, and naming it when I do.
We have a first email here from Becca in rural Lane County, is how she usually identifies herself. And she writes, how do you teach this when there are no black kids in the classes, i.e. lots of rural Western Oregon?
So one way I teach it is, of course, we have all kinds of media, toys, books, that I would start with my kids young, engaging, not just having that in my home, but also explicitly engaging with those materials with my kids, pointing out difference in those materials, teaching them the vocabulary of African American and Native American and White American. And then as they get older, actually noticing that we live in a part of the country that is mostly white and starting to teach them the history about that part of their country. That part of the country was not always white. And so our kids from young ages need to learn about indigenous peoples and different native cultures and about the real struggles and engagements between, colonizing Europeans and indigenous peoples, and so that they start to realize, even when we live in segregated enclaves, that that came from somewhere.
This is about the point, though, when I think you start to get some people folding their arms and saying, well, you really want to just induce shame in our kids growing up. But that I can't believe that would be it. What is it you're seeking to instill?
So I'm seeking to instill a sense of accurate history and awareness that one can make different choices. So when my daughter says to me, my 8-year-old did say to me one time, were all the Europeans, were they all bad? And I recognized that sort of shame and guilt moment. But rather than shutting it down and by effectively telling her a lie and saying, no, everything's actually was fine, saying, you know what, there were really awful things that European Americans did, including some of our own ancestors. And some of our ancestors fought those things. But most importantly, what we need to know is that today, we can challenge and fight those things and the legacies that they left us and create a different, more just present. And that avoids sort of getting stuck in shame and instead truthfully invites our children to see themselves as moral agents who can help create the kind of society that everybody's child deserves to live in.
We are not bound by the actions of the past.
That's right.
Which is the whole point of this book, Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Jennifer Harvey is the author from Drake University in Des Moines and our guest on The Exchange. So back into the terminology you use here, I touched on this already, but you want us to think of ourselves as colorblind, not as colorblind. It's well-intentioned, you say, but harmful. How?
Well, it's harmful because, first of all, communities of color have said to white Americans a billion times now, we want you to see our difference. We want our race is important to us. And so color blindness, just right off the bat, just ignores what people of color have already told us about their racial identity mattering to them. It's harmful because when I tell a white child, don't notice color, what they hear is, oh, don't notice that dark skin. We're not going to hold that against that person. And so it actually induces bias by implying, even though it's not the intention, that there's something wrong with being black or Latino and that we're not going to hold it against that person that they have that identity. Instead, we're going to treat them just the same as we treat anybody else. So in this really insidious way, it actually positions dark skin or racial identities that are not white as negative somehow, and that we're going to sort of grant people permission to be fully human despite that.
Let's bring this all the way back to square one, because you do point out in the book, obviously race is not real biologically, but you say in our culture it is real anyway.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, race is a social construction, which just simply means it's come to have meaning over time. There's no DNA code that means any racial group is predisposed to any sort of attribute, behavior, anything like that. A lot of times our racist discourses in society tell us that that's the case, and it's not. And you can go to another part of the world and different categories and different skin tones or hair textures are marked in different ways. And so what's significant is the social, political, the family, the generational meanings that accrue over time to these categories that we have built, just like we built our houses.
So you bring up the nurture shock study in which babies notice skin color. I found this fascinating, but that does not mean we are racism genetically or something, right?
I don't think we have to be, no. I mean, I think what that study tells us when they've observed infants noticing skin tone difference shows us that, I mean, partly I introduced that study to sort of neurologically just say color blindness isn't a thing unless you actually have an eye impairment. We see color. And so, right, you know, that's another off the bat way we're setting children up for failure if we say be colorblind when they see it everywhere. But prejudice and racism doesn't happen until we attach negative and positive meanings to those skin tone differences. And that does happen very, very early for children because of the society we live in. Three-year-olds start to perceive difference and internalize the negative and positive messages that they get from society about skin tone differences. But that process is not inevitable. We can interrupt and challenge and constantly be seeking to transform that process with our kids.
Jennifer Harvey, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor at Drake University in Des Moines, works on racial justice and white anti-racism. She is also an ordained minister in American Baptist churches. Her latest book is called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. You can join this conversation on the Exchange. There's a lot to say here. 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And again, for the parents who think, well, I don't need this book because I'm very anti-racist myself, but the things that other people can teach your kids without you even realizing it are really relatively shocking. You bring up the story of your own daughter making gender assumptions, saying she thinks God is a boy. Where did she get that?
That's right. I mean, this is, you know, my kids are being raised by two moms. We're feminists, and I'm a pastor who is a feminist, and she gets that from living in a world where sexism is alive and well. And in lots of subtle ways, even four-year-olds, five-year-olds know that boys get treated in, you know, better ways in some contexts than girls. And so that's a great example of smog being in the air. We've even put anti-sexist breathing masks on her. And at age four, she said, well, God must be a boy because boys are better than girls. And it was the longest Facebook therapy session of my life when she said that to me.
I'm going to believe it. So it's not just that we have to teach our kids our values, but we also have to correct some messages they get from elsewhere.
That's right. And we have to help them see where those messages come from. And so as much as I wanted to panic in that moment and say to her, well, like, what are you talking about? My job as a parent, and I don't always do it well, is to say, wow, I'm really surprised to hear you say that. I wonder if we can talk some more about that. Why would you think boys are better than girls? You know, have you seen that in the world? Has someone told you that? I don't think that's true. So could we, you know, I disagree with you. Could we sort of explore this as we move forward? It's not about jumping on our kids and saying, oh, you're so wrong in this moment. It's about continuing to invite the conversation with them and continuing to help them build their moral imagination for a world that is just and equitable and that they have a part in helping to create.
So here again, take a breath.
Take a breath.
Be careful not to say, don't ever say that.
That's
or,
right.
Where did you get that from?
That's
but
right.
Be a lot more intentioned than that.
Because that's where you induce shame, actually, is when you shut things down. That's when shame can begin to hover. It's when we invite the conversation and we do redirect and correct. I mean, we want to teach our values, but not in a sort of adult imposing kind of you're wrong and bad for having thought this kind of way.
So let's get another case study here, because you talk about this case of kids pulling a wagon, little girls, and a white girl tells an Asian girl, only white Americans can pull this wagon. If it were your situation to use as a teachable moment, how would you use it with those kids?
Well, I think the first thing I would do is I would realize that I had not yet proactively done what I needed to do in whatever the environment, whether it was a classroom or my home life, to make sure I would be looking around and going, okay, where do I need to really up my game in a proactive way around this kind of messaging? I would absolutely, with the child, if it was my child or a child I was teaching, I would make sure that we sat down together and she apologized to the Asian American girl that she had said that to, and that she had, you know, sort of had to go through the, you know, taking responsibility for having really hurt someone. And then I would use that moment as information about what kinds of either conversations as a parent or teachings in the classroom I wanted to proactively create to help my four-year-old start to talk about, okay, well, what is Americanness? Again, where did you hear that? Did you hear that on the news? You know, people in the news are saying things like that. Let's talk about that. What do borders mean? Let's talk about that. Why do people cross borders? Let's talk about that. And those kinds of conversations that go beyond just the particular moment where racial harm is done and help us sort of get in our children's or our students' consciousness and actively kind of shape and grow it in a different way.
Particularly for a younger child, can this be a two-step process where you first do a trace back about, you know, where they got this idea and then maybe do a correction in a separate session, or is it best handled all in one?
You know, for me, it's often absolutely best as a two-step, because sometimes in the moment I don't know what to say. And so, you know, one time I heard my three-year-old singing One Little, Two Little, Three Little Indians, and I knew, I need to talk to her about that. But in the moment, I just let it go because I wasn't sure how to handle it. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to use the word genocide with my three-year-old, but I also need to redirect this behavior. And so I waited about 4 or 5 hours to give myself some time to kind of strategize and think, okay, what does she need to know? What does she need to be asked? And what is better left for maybe a year or two from now? And so I think, especially when you're a parent, we have this gift of getting to circle back and circle back and circle back. And as long as we do that, sometimes taking two steps or even three is absolutely the right thing to do.
Jennifer Harvey, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Raising White Kids. Here is Kevin in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, this is definitely a subject that is just full of lots of stuff to become familiar with. I'm glad to hear the parenting dimension of this whole thing and coming through clearly. Parenting is something I've taken very seriously since I was a parent, not before that. And it's just, all these issues around racism, all races are racist, in my opinion. I mean, some more than others, and you can do that with that what you want. But so to me, the key for getting your kids to be able to navigate their way through this horrible situation is their principles, particularly their principles, how they interact with human beings, must be very clearly defined and must be very clearly supported by the family. If you're just going to break it down into either this is the bad race and all the other ones are pretty good, in the process of doing that, you're ignoring the reality, which again is a kind of a postmodernist sense of consciousness, and it's never going to work anyway. Everybody's got to be respectful to one another. We don't have to go back in history and say, oh, I owe you forever because of these awful things. And this is one thing I noticed as a parent. I homeschooled my children, and they went to, music conservatories and Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, all these things. And to keep my kids out of public schools, because in public schools there's this fight going on all the time as to, who's the bad guy, who needs more attention, whatnot. It's just, school teachers and administrators are not the parents. They're trying hard to have a lot of control here, but until they can get the parents to really teach the kids what they need to learn, the progress that they're looking for is not going to happen.
All right, Kevin, thank you for your thoughts, and I wonder if you have some responses, Jennifer.
Yeah, I have a couple. I mean, one, I absolutely agree with you, Kevin, that this is not for me about fixing any group of people as bad or good. Humanity is much more complex than that, and it does no child any good to either fix themselves as just one thing or the other, or anybody else. But where I would disagree, I think, is that, so I do want my children to live into and grow into the principle of kindness, for example. That's a value, a principle that I want to instill in them. But if they are living in a society and they are encountering things on the school playground where kindness, that in some cases that's a generic principle, but when racist meanness is happening, I don't think kindness is enough for them to be a good ally to their friends of color when their friends of color get treated in racialized and racist ways. And more importantly, as they grow, if I don't teach them about racism, not to tell them that they're bad, but actually to tell them that they can also be anti-racist, then they will end up, some of the problems and challenges we have in schools is that our youth have the same tensions amongst themselves as we adults have, and white youth who have not been taught to identify with their peers of color and the racist experiences that their peers are having are also unable to sustain authentic friendships with those kids. And so diversity ends up failing us, and we're unable to maintain good interracial relationships.
All right, more to talk about with diversity and where it meets race consciousness, and we'll get into that when we return to the Jefferson Exchange after a break. The book is called Raising White Kids, subtitled Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. It's the work of Jennifer Harvey, our guest from Brake University in Des Moines. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take more phone calls and emails in a minute 15. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange, and we're continuing a discussion about how to raise children who are not racist in America. Jennifer Harvey is a professor at Drake University in Des Moines, an ordained minister in American Baptist churches. Her latest book is called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. She's not talking about being non-racist. She's talking about being anti-racist. And we'll get further into the terms as we continue the discussion. You are welcome to join it, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We just touched on the term diversity, and you do say in the book, Jennifer, it's very important to differentiate race-conscious parenting from teaching diversity. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this gets harder, but it's important. Diversity, teaching our kids to value diversity is certainly improvement over colorblindness, so-called colorblindness. But one of the things that I think is going on in this country right now is that diversity rests on this premise that we can and should celebrate all difference. And that becomes difficult when we talk about living in an unjust society where white Americans, whether we want to be or not, experience privilege, experience inequitable access. And so some of the things that I see happen among my college students, right, and I think also happens probably in high schools, is white kids are being told, value diversity, you're supposed to, you know, embrace difference, but there's this elephant in the room by which they don't know what they're supposed to do with their white difference, and we all kind of know that it's not the same thing to say and celebrate blackness as it is to celebrate whiteness, right, which has more resonance of, you know, KKK, kind of neo-Nazi kinds of things. And so we've really left white youth with no way to position themselves in diversity conversations. And that's why getting anti-racism and their ability to sort of live into an anti-racist white identity is critically important, because without that, lots of white youth end up just resenting the whole enterprise of diversity, and actually they turn that resentment on their peers of color. And so we've got to, as adults and teachers, parents, all of us, give them better models, better language, more conversation about active agency-filled anti-racist whiteness as part of the diversity project.
How, though? I mean, because I think you're clear in the book that you don't expect or want white kids to be walking around saying white is beautiful the
right way
kids of color will walk around saying black is beautiful. At the same time, though, you say that it's important to communicate that white skin is not the standard or the default setting for human beings.
Right. I mean, one way, I mean, I think about what we're teaching our kids at home and what we teach them at school about history. So when we talk about black history, for example, which is critically important, do we also talk about and introduce all kids to the much smaller number, but those few historical figures who were anti-racist in their behaviors, people like John Brown, who allied with Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, and he was white, but he lived out an anti-racist commitment as a white American. That's just one example of the kinds of filling the gaps in what we see as possible for human beings when we're talking about race with our kids and with our youth. And again, that can start very, very young. But it's a big gap in our sort of social conversation about race that we have to do a lot of work to fill.
So it sounds like we're left with a situation where what we're saying is because these things happened in the past, we can't do these things in the present.
What do you mean? That you can't just say, like, yay, celebrate whiteness, for example?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, and I'm not suggesting anybody should.
Sure.
I just want to be clear on that.
Yeah,
too.
Right. Well, I think one thing that's going on, and actually I wanted to say this about, this came up in Kevin's comment as well, one of the misnomers here, often when we talk about racial injustice, we find ourselves talking a lot about history, and in fact, we all know, but we need to keep renaming that all of these dynamics we're talking about are happening right now. I mean, we can look at everything from rates of police brutality in communities of color to access to high-quality education or higher education, and we can see all the ways that racial disparities continue to be the experience for all of us, and we just enter at different places. And so it's a present conversation, and I think if I think about a high school, for white youth in a very multiracial, diverse high school, teachers, or if I was the parent of that youth, modeling how do we make sure within that high school that all kids are getting equal access to AP courses, for example. That's a way of partnering with my youth, my white youth, to position themselves as an active anti-racist ally in the institution that they're spending, you know, many hours of their week in. And we need to do more of that so that white youth, white adults, white kids see themselves as part of this larger push that people of color are leading to create a more racially just society, that we can be part of that, but white youth need those of us who are a little older to sort of mentor and support them in that work, help them find entry points.
Another phone call here from David in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Harvey, the author of Raising White Kids.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Matt. Thank you very much for the intelligence for the conversation. Just a little story. I'm the father of a sole son, Caucasian kid, now 22, raised in the southern part of Oregon. And while we read books to him featuring Native Americans and Chinese Americans, and he had less of a actual experience of people of color and diversity, but he did a beginning intellectual on understanding. He had friends that were, had parents that were Native, that were Chinese, and friends from household with two moms by the time he was four. But at that point, we started going to Southern Oregon University basketball games. There came the day when an African-American young man got out of a car next to ours in Ashland, and my son looked at me and he said, "Dad, is he a basketball player?" And the gentleman looked over top of his horn-rimmed glasses at me with this very baleful look. And right there, I thought, uh-oh, I got to do something here. So basically and simply, we started traveling with him. And we started taking him to more racially diverse cities like San Francisco and Chicago and simply going to public places, whether it being an airport or a park or restaurants, so that he could be in a physical space with people of various colors and ethnic backgrounds of various shapes, sizes, ages, and then simply follow his lead and asking questions.
Yeah.
And having him exposed to a broader sense of humanity.
David, thank you so much for sharing the story of your efforts with your own children. And how does that square with what you're talking about here, Jennifer?
Yeah, David, thanks for that. I think that's a great example of deciding that we have to make a active, prioritized choice to take the lead on changing what our kids experience, see, and learn. And what David's talking about is the real phenomena of the way segregation, which we are a very segregated nation all across the board, segregation impacts our kids, even if we're doing lots of kinds of teaching, anti-racist teaching in the home. And we have to figure out ways to desegregate our lives. And so, you know, traveling is one way to do it. Those of us that live in a less rural part of our state have other choices that we can make. But that's a perfect example of recognizing that just our basic living conditions, because we are living these legacies of segregation, in and of itself are going to lead our children to develop racist sensibilities, even if we are actively seeking to counter that, and that we can and we have to prioritize trying to every day in lots of different ways undo that.
Would there have been a chance, because you cite some similar things where younger kids would say things about people with darker skin, I wonder if there was an opportunity missed in that moment with you know, Dad, is he a basketball player, to say something, you know, if a parent had the presence of mind, which obviously would have been hard in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things white people do a lot, and I've certainly done this, is I cause a harm to someone who's a person of color, and I'm so embarrassed by that that I like run away and don't deal with it instead of owning it and apologizing. And as awkward as it would be, I always think that choosing to model for our kids an apology, even if it's, you know, I'm sorry that my child just said that to you. I don't know if it made you uncomfortable, but I apologize. I don't know how that would have landed with that young man that was getting out of the car. But for me, and this is difficult, always trying in the moment when our kids do something that, you know, causes harm to somebody else, even if it's an awkward, ambiguous situation, really just owning it and trying our best to sort of name it and in the very sort of basic work of being like, you know what, I see you. I see that that just happened. I can't exactly fix this, but I want to acknowledge that that might have hurt, and I'm sorry.
All right, let's take another call here. Mark in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Harvey.
Good morning, Reverend Harvey. I wanted to relate an experience with my children who were half Filipino when I was growing up in, or when they were growing up in San Diego. We moved into a residence in Oak Park, a suburb. And I was thrilled because the school was only three blocks away from our house. Mm. And then when school started, I got this note home from the administration telling me that because my kids were Hispanic, they were going to get bused to La Jolla, which was 45 minutes away every day. And so I thought, wait a minute. So I went down to the school and I said to the principal, how is it that you think my kids are what do you think they are? And he says, well, they're obviously Mexican-American. And I said, well, wait a minute. Actually, no, their phenotype is Tagalog. Their ancestry is from the Philippines. But we speak only English at home because I'm since divorced. My wife, I've got custody. So I said, we speak primarily English. And, in fact, we identify with the white community. But I might be thrilled to have my kids go across town anyway so that they can be in a mixed school where all these mixed kids are getting bused. And he looked at me and says, oh, I'm so sorry. And so they didn't have to get bused. But what we have is administrators sometimes mistakenly identifying children by phenotype and making erroneous decisions that affect our children.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that these days, I'm not sure that that's gotten any better, but I'm hoping it's gotten better.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Can I just say, Jeff, that story, you know, makes me think about something else that's so important here. That, you know, one of the things I realized when I started writing this book is that it's also really difficult when we're talking about raising kids in a different way and teaching white children about difference and race and practicing the language of race and racial identity with them, is that we also, it's true that there's these risks that also come up with that around making assumptions about other people based on what they look like. And, of course, during the Civil Rights Movement, that's what we learned that we need not to do. And so there is this real complexity with teaching children about race where, now in this case, it was school administrators making assumptions, you know, based on what, you know, someone looked like. But I also try with my own kids to constantly say things like, you know what, that person might be African American, but I'm not sure, and sort of model for them also that these categories, even while we want to both honor when folks tell us who they are and use those that language and those names that people have chosen, also sort of constantly model appropriate curiosity and sort of incompleteness, because we don't always know how someone identifies, and we have to model that for our children too. And so this really is hard work. It's urgent work, but it is complicated.
So Jennifer, the parents who just want their kids to stay innocent of racism, if they don't take it up, what do you see happening?
Well, I mean, at best, what I see happening is that they are raising children who stand on the sidelines while black kids and Latino kids and Native kids, kids of color, experience all kinds of harms in society. And so keeping the white child innocent essentially, to my mind, means insulating them to stay numb in the face of other human beings experiencing harm. And to my mind, as a, you know, as a pastor, as an ethicist, that's really kind of bartering away their humanity. Because if we're living in a system where some people's children are not insulated, then innocence is really kind of an agreement to sort of just stay out of it while letting other people's kids be harmed. And so for me as a parent, that is not the kind of human that I want to raise.
We have an email here from Ariel, no town given, says, I tuned in late and may have missed this point. It is also important to remember that each person is a unique individual.
Yeah.
People who are of a race that is not easily identifiable are often asked, what are you, when first meeting someone?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point, and that's a little bit sort of goes back to what I was saying about not making assumptions. I'm not teaching my kids to go up to folks and say, hey, what race are you, right? That's not, also, that's not appropriate. That's not kind. That's not how anybody should be treated. And so that's part of sort of this nuanced and complex work of constantly noticing race and continually undermining that we can make any assumptions about somebody just based on their race. And so I sort of dig into that a little bit more in the book about some of the ways that we know that we can do that. But it's also this kind of imperfect work that we kind of constantly have to be paying attention to what we hear our kids say. And then if we hear them saying things that seem like they're putting people in boxes, we need to actively try and undo that as well.
I apologize that I only have about 30 seconds for an answer to this, but you got grandparents and other relatives here. How deal with the things that they may demonstrate in opposition to what the parents teach?
Yeah, well, one is I talk to those folks. If they're going to have a lot of access, unsupervised access to my children, then I engage them on these questions. And the other is our kids need to see us model appropriate anti-racist interventions even with family members. And so if things come up and the kid is in the room, addressing it in a respectful way, but letting our kids see, hey, when you hear stuff, even if it's a grandparent, you say something.
We've had our minds expanded. The book is called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. It's the work of Jennifer Harvey, professor at Drake University in Des Moines and an ordained minister in American Baptist churches. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Take care.